It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to a Latin jazz band leader about the jazz music scene here in Wisconsin.
First, former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold is both putting pressure on his opponent Ron Johnson and taking fire himself over the issue of campaign finance.
Late last week, Feingold proposed an idea to Senator Ron Johnson that they pledged to keep third-party spending out of their 2016 Senate race. Today, Feingold himself is taking heat for the spending of his political action committee, Progressives United.
According to data compiled by OpenSecrets.org, of the $7.1 million that the PAC raised, only 5% went to federal candidates and political parties. Large amounts of that money went to further fundraising and salaries for Feingold and his former staff members.
Here now to talk about Feingold's proposed pledge and the spending of his own political action committee is Daniel Bice, political watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Daniel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks.
Well, let's first talk about this challenge, this proposal to curb third-party spending in this race for Senate 2016 in Wisconsin. What exactly is the now challenger Russ Feingold calling for there?
It's a clever thing that was done in a Massachusetts race with Elizabeth Warren. And essentially, it would say if a third-party group spent money in their race, the one that benefited from that would have to pay, would have to cover half of the expense of the ad and give it to a charity of the choice of his opponent. So if someone came in and did an ad attacking Feingold, Ron Johnson would have to pay the equivalent of half of the cost of the attack ad and give it to a charity that Feingold would choose.
So that's a little more teeth in this proposal than just saying we're going to ask third-party candidates that we don't, or parties that we don't control, not to spend and hope for the best.
Right. I mean, it makes the candidates have to pay something. But I would really seriously doubt that Ron Johnson's going to agree to this. And as a result, it allows Russ Feingold to say when these ads are going to come in, and if there is not an agreement like this, they are going to come in since this is such a highly targeted race. It will allow Russ Feingold to say, see, I wanted to stop these things, but I couldn't because of my opponent.
So is this, do you think, from what we can tell, more of a political salvo than something that is really likely to happen?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen, but it does, as you said, it's a clever idea in terms of making the candidates hold some responsibility for the ads that are being done in their support. You know, one interesting thing is, though, frequently candidates don't like these ads, even though they're supposed to benefit from them. There are any number of instances where third-party groups ran ads that ended up hurting the candidate that they intended to help.
And now, you mentioned this has been done before, Senator Elizabeth Warren against, I think, Scott Brown in Massachusetts.
Right.
So how did this pay out? Did anybody have to shell out money to balance the books here?
To tell you the truth, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I didn't follow that race, but you know, Feingold saw this thing and decided it would be a good idea to do it here.
And Feingold, has he said what he would do if the Johnson campaign doesn't sign on?
They're saying that it's only binding if both parties do it.
And we haven't heard from Senator Johnson's campaign staff.
It's been 3 days. Yeah, he hasn't said anything in 3 days. And it would make no sense for Feingold to do it just on his own because it would be tying his hands while allowing the other side to do whatever they wanted.
In effect, it would be unilateral disarmament.
Right. Yeah, it would not be a good idea in a race like this one that's so important, you know, to the political landscape and for the U.S. Senate.
As you say, this has got a lot of national attention. Unless some deal is reached, we could probably, based on past experience, I imagine, expect to see a lot of outside money coming in here.
Sure. The funny thing is there wasn't a great deal of outside money in the Baldwin-Thompson race. It was mainly the candidates themselves. I believe it was like $3 or $4 million that was spent by outside groups. But the stakes were not as high for that as they are for this race.
Talking to Daniel Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a couple of stories in the news this weekend and today about the race for the U.S. Senate here in Wisconsin. Former Senator Russ Feingold challenging current incumbent Senator Ron Johnson. Well, let's move on to this other issue, the Russ Feingold Progressives United PAC. And this is something you've been reporting on over the weekend. Give us the basics of the story, please.
When Russ Feingold lost and he left office in 2011, he set up actually two groups, a political action committee, a PAC, and also a nonprofit, a political nonprofit. And I just decided to look and see what had been done and how he had spent his money. The PAC itself had raised and spent about $7.1 million. And of that, only 5% ended up going directly to candidates. And in their electoral mission, they said they're trying to give money directly and indirectly to candidates. Instead, the bulk of the money went for overhead. 95% of it went for overhead, including fundraising, administrative expenses, and salaries for staffers. And at various points, the Political Action Committee had 10 former Feingold campaign aides or U.S. Senate aides working for it.
And we've heard from Republicans now here in the state saying, in effect, this wasn't really a PAC, a Political Action Committee. It was a, these aren't their words, but a holding tank for Russ Feingold's campaign.
Or slush fund or something like that. You know, what it essentially was, it did allow, I mean, it created a way for all of these staffers to have employment in between these two elections. But also, I lost my train of thought there. It's not so much a holding tank or something like that. They end up endorsing candidates and allowing people to choose to give money to those people. And they said they raised about $1.6 million that way. But even if you combine that with their direct giving, it's still a fraction of the $7.1 million that they raised and spent.
So, yeah, what have we heard from Democrats, from Feingold himself, and if anything, or Progressives United in response?
Well, Feingold surprised me. He decided to put out a fundraising letter in response to this. He said, look, I'm already under attack. If you want to help me, you need to give money to me now. So that was been the main response on that side. I was actually surprised. With stories like this, I usually end up getting inundated with calls from liberals who are upset about the story, but I didn't have that happen today. I instead got a lot of people saying, I wish he hadn't done this.
Does this? Do we know how this compares with other political action committees? Do they typically put more of their money into political action?
Yeah. You can look at Ron Johnson's campaign committee. He has a political action committee, and it spent about 2/3 of its money on giving money to candidates, and then about 20% for fundraising, and then 5% for salary. So it's pretty significantly different from what Russ Feingold did.
And do we know where all this money for Progressives United came from?
It came from a lot of people. There are hundreds and hundreds of people who donated $50, $75, $100. There are bigger donors. Lynn Eline is one of the major contributors. And they're very open about who's given. You can go to their website and see they've grouped them into the largest contributors and then several other categories of who gave money.
Now that Russ Feingold is in the transformation from non-candidate to candidate, what happens to the PAC he runs?
They're scaling it back. They've moved most of the staff members over to his campaign, just as most people would expect. So the most of his fundraising effort's going to go for him. They've made the PAC. It had to actually show what sort of money it was spending every month, and now they've changed it to quarterly because it's just not doing any work. And the nonprofit that he created shut down in December. It raised about $2.9 million over its 4 years. So to go combined, these two groups, he was able to raise $10 million for the two organizations. And the nonprofit, again, it's an interesting thing. Half of the money ended up going to fundraising just like this. And then another 40% ended up going to salaries for his former staffers. So 90% of its spending was for salaries or fundraising.
As we mentioned earlier, Republican critics of Russ Feingold have already made an issue of this. Do you think this is something we'll be hearing about as the race goes on in the next, 16 months
yes,
or so?
16 months. You know, the best thing that could have happened to Feingold was the fact that I did the story now, because it's got so much time. By the time September of next year rolls around, this will be pretty old story. But, you know, it is interesting. What we have is one candidate in Ron Johnson who had his firm pay him back $10 million in deferred compensation after the 2010 election. And then you have on the other side a candidate who set up these political funds that helped give jobs to his campaign staffers during the intervening years. So you have both of them coming up with interesting ways to raise money for the people around them them and for the candidates themselves. And I should say, Feingold did draw not a huge salary, but he drew some money from both the PAC and the nonprofit during this time up until he took a job with the U.S. State Department.
All right, Dan, thanks, and we'll talk to you again in the future.
Okay, great.
That's Daniel Bice, political watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the latest news in the Wisconsin 2016 Senate race. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Richard Davis is known around the world as one of the best jazz musicians on the planet. Dean Robbins has been a fan for years, and ahead of this weekend's Isthmus Jazz Festival, recalls what drew him to Davis's sound.
Wisconsin isn't the jazz capital of the world, but we do have one thing New York City doesn't have. He's Richard Davis, bass player extraordinaire. Davis has lived in the Madison area since the 1970s, when the University of Wisconsin lured him away from full-time performing to be a professor. He grew up in the Chicago ghetto, strumming on a broom before he got his first bass. He immersed himself in old recordings by Louis Armstrong and other jazz greats that he found in downtown record shops. These self-directed listening sessions would be the foundation of his musical career. Davis's first break came in 1957, when the renowned vocalist Sarah Vaughan hired him as her bass player. But he took a left turn with his next job, partnering with the avant-garde saxophonist Eric Dolphy. I first heard Davis on an edgy Dolphy album called Out to Lunch. The bassist isn't usually the guy who catches your attention, but this one made his presence known. He leaped out of the speakers with booming double stops, expressive glissandos, and soulful bowing. After noting Richard Davis's name on the album jacket, I started seeing it everywhere. There he was, setting the mood on Van Morrison's melancholy pop masterpiece, Astral Weeks.
Well, I'm caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue.
There he was, laying down a suave rhythm behind Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand. He even turned up in orchestral settings, playing under conductors like Leonard Bernstein.
We're going to play for you this fascinating new piece called Improvisations for Orchestra and Jazz Soloists.
Then I moved to Madison and discovered Davis here. It was a thrill to see a musician of his stature playing around town, from concert halls to humble bars. I felt like I'd stumbled into jazz heaven, even though I was 1,000 miles away from New York City. In fact, I saw one of my most memorable Richard Davis shows on a trip to New York. He often headlined there during semester breaks from the university, and I caught him one night at the Village Vanguard. A framed picture of him hung on the club's wall, right near one of Louis Armstrong, the musician he'd idolized as a boy. Davis played with fire that night. With his fluid time and aggressive pizzicato style, he made every chorus an adventure. I watched Davis greeting people in the crowd, including a woman who asked him for directions to Madison, something you wouldn't expect in the middle of Greenwich Village. But the more I thought about the exchange, the more it made sense. Of course anyone interested in the jazz bass would need directions to Madison, because Richard Davis has single-handedly made Madison the jazz bass capital of the world.
Dean Robbins is a writer based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Staying with Wisconsin's jazz scene, this Saturday you can catch our next guest performing at the Isthmus Jazz Festival at the UW-Madison Memorial Union Terrace.
Joining us now in the studio is Tony Castaneda, the band leader for the Tony Castaneda Latin Jazz Band. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me here, you guys.
Well, tell us how you first got started playing Latin jazz.
Back in the early 70s, I guess, growing up, I had an older brother who had, used to listen to a lot of rock, and of course Santana, but of course Jimi Hendrix and Zeppelin and all those other people. And one of my older brothers had a Cal Jader album, the Soul Sauce album, and he used to play it. And he first got turned on to it at that time. And that album is a classic album, and that's kind of how I got started. Then I started playing when I moved to Madison in 74. I hooked up with some guys, and we formed a group called Olmeca, which was Madison's first Latin jazz rock band. This was 1977-78. And they needed a bass player, and I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll pick up a bass. So I was going to borrow a bass from a bass playing friend of mine, and instead I said, nah, why don't you just come to the rehearsal? And I went, and their conga player was unavailable and couldn't play because he was working at work conflict, so I just started playing conga at the time. And I, with them, and I had an old conga that I used to, you know, beat up on playing along with Santana albums and stuff like that. But that's how I started playing with that band.
You've been a percussionist ever since, and that was based, your musical career was based in part on who didn't show up at practice.
That happened. But actually, when I was a little kid, though, I should go way back, though, to the 60s. My uncle, Nacio, played in a Latin band, a Latin ensemble, back in the 50s and 60s in Racine, Milwaukee area. And he was a self-taught musician. He played saxophone, trumpet, guitar, piano. He had a drum set in his basement, all that. And he tried to get me and my brothers hooked on that. And he actually bought me my first trumpet, and I stuck with it. And that was my first instrument, was trumpet, like in fifth grade. And I used to play in a marching band and kind of an orchestra band. And, you know, I eventually played bugle in a drum and bugle corps, like when I was in eighth and ninth grade. I actually got to play at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas for nationals, so I played at the Cotton Bowl.
So a long string of experiences with music, but now you've settled on the percussion. You're the band leader as well. Is the percussion part of that more important in Latin jazz, would you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the heart. That's the soul of it. The Afro-Cuban beat, the rhythm, the instruments, I mean, that's what drives Latin jazz especially. And that's what, you know, when you go back to the history of what became Latin jazz, you talk to Tito Puente and those guys, and they're like, well, yeah, they had their Latin music, and then right around the block in New York would be the jazz clubs. And when there was a break, the musicians from the Latin clubs would walk over to the jazz clubs, and they'd play and sit in, and then the jazz guys would come over there, and they've had that marriage ever since. So, yeah.
Talking to Tony Castaneda, band leader here in Wisconsin, about playing Latin jazz here in the state. So Latin music, a lot of different traditions, not just one thing. Jazz music, a lot of different traditions. So how does it all get woven together to become something we'd call Latin jazz?
Well, like I said, it went back to way back in those days. And people like Tito Puente were some of the first to bring these people together. Mongo Santa Maria, Cal Jader, of course, is a big name on that, and my band does probably two sets of Cal Jader music. It's been there for a long time, and it's separate than regular jazz, and it's separate than from Latin music and you know, a lot of the traditional Latin music too. But that marriage there is very essential, and it's like I said, it's been around for a long time.
So you've been playing for a long time. Your band has been around for a long time. How has it changed over the years? What would you say you're moving into now?
Well, in 98, we formed the Tony Castaneda, the Latin Jazz. It was a trio at the time. Dave Stoller, he's been playing in Madison for a long time on keyboards, and Henry Baim on bass. We grew from that period, and got a flute player, then we got a timbale player, then we got a sax player. So we've been quartet, quintet, sextet, septet at times, and sometimes even bigger when we have, bring up special guest musicians with us. So since 98, we've been playing. We've been honored to be voted Madison's top jazz band since 2000 all the way up to 2015. We missed 1 year there. I don't know what happened. It's good.
Well, let's talk about doing this in Wisconsin. You were a first, you said, back in the 70s. Was there a hunger for music that brought together Latin influences and jazz? Were people wanting to see this?
Obviously, because now in Madison itself, at that time we were the only and first Latin jazz rock band, I guess, because we were more kind of rocky. in more ways than one. Now there's at least 20 bands, Latin influenced bands in Madison, Marisalsa, Grupo Candela, Son Contrabando, all these great bands playing different genres of Latin jazz. Some are playing salsa, some are playing more jazz oriented stuff. So, yeah.
How would you describe the jazz scene and Latin jazz scene in Madison? Is Madison, does it have a thriving scene today?
I say Madison has a good jazz scene, and I can't speak for the rest of the state, but we've got a lot of clubs, actually a lot more clubs to play than we did in a lot of other places also. So I think it's good, and one of the best things about it is that you're seeing a lot of high school jazz bands starting up, or that have been playing for a while. Sun Prairie has a great jazz band. East High School has a great jazz band, and they're getting us older musicians are presenting these people. We're bringing them out to some of the festivals, and the Madison Jazz Consortium is introducing jazz, and it's cool. It's part of the regular high school band thing.
All right. Well, Tony, thanks a lot for coming in and sharing
and
your
thanks,
experience.
And thanks, and I want to make sure that everybody gets to the Isthmus Jazz Festival. We are actually going to be hopefully playing, we're working on some Ornette Coleman tunes.
Ooh, in tribute.
That we're going to, yes, in tribute to Ornette Coleman. It's going to be hard to translate those, so thank you very much.
Tony Castaneda, Madison-based jazz musician.
Out with his music here on Central Time.
Since the early days of the internet, there have been plenty of places for online discussions, conversations, and the exchange of ideas. Although, as anyone who's ever visited the comments section of their favorite news website knows, things can get ugly and in some cases turning to threats and harassment.
Many sites have tried to create community management policies and moderation, but there have been some places that have been relatively hands-off.
The website Reddit has long been considered one of those places, but last week the site's leadership announced that a handful of the site's worst offenders, forums devoted to racism, transphobia, and fat-shaming were being banned.
Reddit not alone in those efforts. Social network Twitter, another place where almost anything had gone, is also taking new steps to counter bullying and trolling, enabling users to share lists of accounts that they've blocked with other people. So why are we seeing these sites take action now, especially after years of a hands-off approach? Will it actually work in cracking down on online harassment, a problem that seems to have gotten worse in recent years?
Joining us now is Anne-Marie Dooling. She's head of growth at Vocative. She's also a former community strategist for Salon, Yahoo, and the Huffington Post. Anne-Marie, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start specifically looking at Reddit. Now, for people who might not be familiar, this is basically a big collection of forums, thousands of forums called subreddits for all kinds of interest groups. What happened on Reddit recently with the new bans?
Well, Reddit went bonkers, for lack of better terminology. So you're absolutely right that Reddit is actually a platform. I think a lot of people make the mistake of calling it a community, which would imply that it's one large group of people. But it's actually just like a blogging platform where you have many different groups using the platform for their own groups and their own interests. And I guess that when there's any platform where you can use it for your own interest, there are always going to be people who use it for things that are not fantastic. So Reddit has been largely hands-off since their creation, allowing people to moderate their own groups and to sort of figure things out among themselves. And recently they decided to be a little more hands-on and take action and get rid of and ban some of these subreddits that were not the public's interest. So now they have a lot of users that are getting really angry at them, wondering if their subreddits are going to be next, wondering where the line is going to be drawn in regards to what's going to be deleted. And honestly, these subreddits that they're banning are just popping right back up with the same groups of people, because if you go ahead and delete whole groups like that, you sort of give them a common enemy and you give them something to work towards.
What exactly has Reddit said that it's banning? It says it's not really banning the ideas or the discussion. So what is Reddit banning?
So Reddit is just getting rid of the subreddits themselves that lead to these specific groups. And I know there was one in particular on fat shaming. And that was a horrible group where people would get together to post pictures of large people, obese people, overeaters, and that I think is a really good example of sort of a hate group and something that Reddit doesn't want to associate itself with. I mean, when you think about Reddit's growth, they have so many users, but what they really want is to be more of a content platform. So, you know, recently they've just hired a lot of people to deal with the news media, to deal with video production, and it just looks really bad for them to have subreddits that are actual hate groups and have actual hate speech. So they're banning these groups, and I mean, obviously they can't moderate morals. If someone's going to think this way, they're going to think about it with Reddit or not with Reddit. But they delete the entire subreddit, and then obviously the groups of people are communicating elsewhere through DMs because they're not getting deleted, their personal accounts, and they're just creating these subreddits right over again.
Now, there was hate speech involved. Sounds like there was also doxing, the practice of sharing someone's personal information online. There was also threats. Is that the more tangible part of what Reddit was objecting to, things like that?
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that everyone really has to deal with, whether you're Reddit or, you know, news comments or even other communities and forums. Doxing is one of those things that everyone needs to be careful for. When you have online communities, you're going to have some degree of hate speech because, like I said, you cannot moderate someone's morals. And I think that largely communities moderate themselves, and the degree of incivility really has to do with what the topic is and what the larger community allows. So when you have these online communities that don't moderate or don't delete this kind of speech, it just sort of snowballs from there and keeps going. But with something like doxing, where you're giving out someone's personal information, there are liabilities with things like that. So obviously, from, you know, Reddit to news communities, you have to grab that stuff fast. And that's why a lot of people pre-moderate, and they'll pre-moderate for specific terminology like email, the end of email addresses, or names, or, you know, if a big topic is coming up or a person has been attacked on their platform, they'll even do searches for that just to make sure that people aren't doxing those specific people.
And sites like Reddit, they are walking that line between protecting users and preserving free speech. Is there an easy way to do that, or is it always going to be a difficult act to pull off that's going to alienate some people?
There's really no such thing as freedom of speech when you're dealing with a private community. I think that's something that a lot of users don't understand. Even, you know, from my perspective, moderating news communities for 10 years, we constantly have people who will say they're being censored or we're taking away their freedom of speech. But when you own a private community, that just doesn't exist because it's not public interest. It's, you know, it's a private community in a private area to moderate as we please. But I think Reddit actually has done a really fantastic job, and they're maybe one of the only communities that we can say has allowed people to continue with their own interests while sort of still keeping an eye out. Because the actual Reddit moderation team, as far as the last time I checked, was really small. And that's the administrators. And then you have the moderators that are self-selecting and self-creating these own subreddits, and they're doing most of the work, and those are the users themselves. So Reddit, in being largely hands-off and allowing the anonymity to continue through these names and these pseudonyms, has really given people a long leash to explore their own interests. And they've really only stepped in a few times. One notable one that I can think of is when the celebrity pics were out and people were sharing the celebrity pics of Jennifer Lawrence and the like. And that's one time when they really stepped forward. But largely, Reddit has been completely hands-off, and I don't think that users could have asked for more than that.
We're talking right now to Anne-Marie Dooling of Vocative.com, talking about how some internet communities, social websites, Twitter and Reddit, are trying to crack down on harassment, and there's been a backlash among people who use those sites. I'm wondering about why this is happening now. Is there a growing sense in the digital world, a growing volume of users, a sense that it doesn't always work to be so hands-off anymore?
Yeah, it really doesn't. And I've worked at communities that have started by not moderating, and I've worked at communities that take the Reddit approach to letting other people moderate. And then I've worked at places that pre-moderate, which means that every comment goes through an administrator before it goes out into the public. And we have a lot of problems on our hands with this sort of thing. I think we just don't live in a time anymore where people associate their offline actions with their online actions. Largely, we try to mimic communities to what we think people do offline, but we now know that the actions people take online are a completely different set of social norms. So when we're trying to create these communities to say, well, someone, you know, wouldn't do that on the street, maybe they won't do it online, it's just not the case anymore. We're just not dealing with that. So it really, you know, we've come to a point where people are saying, how are we acting online? How can we protect other people, which has become something that is really big, not just protecting other users, but when you're talking about news and media sites, I mean, no one wants to work for a site that allows their writers to be attacked. So for news and media, one of the largest problems is how do we let people have an engaged conversation and protect our writers at the same time? And that's really where we start to see different creative options come in. From someone like Twitter that has just created a shared block list. So if you and I are harassed by the same type of person and I've created this fantastic block list of all the people who are attacking me for a specific reason, I can just send it to you and it can mimic that block list for you so you don't have to deal with those people. Or, you know, other sites are just completely turning off comments and closing the conversation altogether, which is unfortunate. But if you can't moderate, then you shouldn't have that dialogue.
Do you think there's also a sense that what happens online doesn't necessarily stay online? If you think about some of the real-world ramifications of scandals like Gamergate, where people felt threatened, had to leave their homes, is there a sense that there's a bleed over between the two, real life and online life?
There is, but, you know, we're dealing with situations where people don't really understand the ramifications of what they're doing online. It's really easy to say, I'm going to make fun of this person. And, I mean, I think we've all at some point been part of Internet Mob. In fact, I know that, you know, there was this story this week where everyone was sort of piling on top of this gentleman who made some pretty sexist remarks about female scientists. And it's very easy to have that gut reaction to say, he's completely wrong. Let's just attack him for this. But we're all part of that Internet Mob. And then the funny thing is that we turn around when we are in the situation of being attacked and say, well, this is wrong. Why are people attacking me? So it's something that, you know, when you're a community manager, you try to be conscious of and you try to make your users aware that we all do it at some point. So for a lot of people, we go to the word troll, right? So we like to say that someone that attacks us online is a troll. And that's just not the real use case of the word, because then we sort of have this picture in our head of a caricature of either, you know, the guy sitting in his dark basement or his mom's basement, and that's just not what it is anymore. We've all been a part of the mob that has attacked someone online. So putting together an idea of how we act online is sort of the first step, and then it's something that I think will just come with time.
We're talking right now with an Internet communities expert, Anne-Marie Dooling from Vocative.com, about how social websites like Twitter and Reddit are trying to crack down on harassment and how these sites walk a line between protecting users and protecting and preserving free speech.
You could join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Do you think social websites or places with an online forum or comments page have an obligation to crack down on harassing or threatening comments? Or would you like to see a hands-off approach? Let choosers use what they read, what they post, and ignore what they want to ignore. Have you been deterred from using certain internet sites or social networks because of harassment or negative attitudes there, or maybe policies you thought were unfair? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about online harassment and what social websites are doing about it now. Anne-Marie Dooling is our guest. She's head of growth at Vocative.com and has served as community strategist for Salon, Yahoo, and the Huffington Post.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done about online threats and harassment? Do sites have an obligation to crack down on the worst offenders, even at the risk of limiting what people could say on their sites? If you've been harassed online, targeted maybe, how do you feel about all of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to start by reading a comment from Peter on Facebook who says, advocates use the word harassment to describe speech they don't like and free speech to describe speech they do like and use this rhetoric to silence disagreement. There are honest-to-goodness people in this world who use the word hate to describe disagreement. People don't realize that whatever mechanisms Reddit and Twitter put into place to stop speech they don't like will also be used to stop speech they do like. Are you okay with banning neo-Nazis if it also means that your side of the abortion debate, whatever side that is also banned? Some big questions there. What do you make of that comment, Anne-Marie?
I think that's a pretty classic argument for people who are, probably engaging in quite a bit of harassment themselves, and B, terrified that their free speech is going to be taken away. And I think that's a perfectly logical fear to have, especially when you invest so much time in getting your thoughts and messages across on a platform that you don't own. However, there is a super clear line, especially to those of us who work in community management and in these forums, on what is harassment and what is not harassment, and that line is usually drawn at personal attacks. So there's something very different in having a forum that is just making fun of someone and then having a forum that, you know, attacks someone, whether that's a specific group of people or a specific person. And I know when we moderate online comments, like I just mentioned, if there is someone who is critical of a writer, we'll tend to leave that, even though the writer might not be super excited to read that. But if someone has a direct attack, such as wishing harm upon someone or saying they're going to go to their house or giving out their information, that's something that shouldn't be there. That's something that would constitute harassment, and that's the kind of thing that should be banned or deleted. And it's really for everyone's own betterment online. And the funny thing is that when you have a lot of these people that are crying out for freedom of speech or they don't want any of these forums taken down, and then you turn the tables and give out their information, suddenly it makes a lot more sense. And then, you know, they're upset that this has happened to them.
Now, a lot of sites have moved to comment sections that require Facebook verification, meaning that your real name has to be accompanied by your comment, not a screen name. What do you think of that approach?
I think it's hysterical because Facebook comments, as anyone who's spent time on a Facebook page knows, are the absolute worst. I've never seen worse, more threatening, less thought out, more generally awful comments than on Facebook pages. And this is coming from someone who has both had to moderate them and just seen them on people's pages. I mean, it really is startling the things people will say and do when they are in an avatar holding their baby or hugging their grandma, or, you know, one minute they're putting up a statement about their religion and then the next they're blatantly attacking someone and cursing like a sailor. So we can use Facebook as a pretty clear example that taking away anonymity does not make conversation more civil. In fact, when you do that, you actually remove the protection from people who want to have a more serious conversation, people who are trying to talk about abuse they went through, or someone who is just coming out in the gay and lesbian or transgendered communities. You're really stripping those people of their protections as well. So I'm definitely a big advocate personally for anonymity and pseudo-anonymity. And I think looking at Facebook, we can make a pretty clear judgment that taking that away doesn't help at all.
Anne-Marie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Anne-Marie Dooling. She's head of growth at Vocative.com and a former community strategist for Salon, Yahoo, and the Huffington Post. She joined us to talk about how social websites are cracking down on harassment.
school districts are struggling to balance their budgets statewide, and tensions over changes at one northern Wisconsin district have reached a boiling point. As Danielle Kading reports, the school board may seek an independent review of the district, superintendent, and the board itself.
Anybody that still needs to sign the petition!
Spooner High School freshman Christopher Dobie is one of more than 100 people that gathered recently to call for Superintendent Michelle Schwab to step down. Dobie feels she and the board are the reason his favorite teacher has decided to leave the district.
I try my hardest for him. I feel I have to accomplish more just to show him what I can do. And now he's not going to be there. I don't know what to think about that.
In the last year, a quarter of the staff has retired, resigned, or their contracts have not been renewed. Mom Danielle Van Buskirk says she's concerned about who will teach her son next year.
And what kind of teachers are we going to get applying here with this dysfunction that's going on in our district?
Van Buskirk accuses the superintendent of intimidation. School board president John Hedlund says board members knew they weren't going to win many friends when they asked their top administrator to deal with the district's $900,000 deficit.
Clearly, we have some needs to address with our budget, but intimidation is not one of those strategies that we want to be a part of it.
Hedlund says the district wanted to renew a referendum several years ago to help with operating costs, but that wasn't supported by voters. Superintendent Michelle Schwab says they're now changing teacher positions, increasing employee health insurance contributions, and considering changes to post-employment benefits.
When you look at the current laws related to the Affordable Care Act, the increase in health insurance premiums, ongoing operating costs of our buildings, and then where our community is located, all of those play into types of revenue that we can get in.
But former teacher Andrew Melton says he and other staff felt bullied by the administration. Melton says he was reprimanded twice for publicly criticizing the district and placed on administrative leave.
I tried to speak to the school board and complain to them, and they just said that there was no grounds for my complaints.
The board president says they couldn't verify Melton's claims without more evidence or witnesses. The administration declined to comment on personnel matters. Hedlund says the board will consider having the Wisconsin Association of School Boards or another group review what's going on in the district.
Because we really are interested in the truth. We're concerned about our teachers and our staff.
State Superintendent Tony Evers says he's not surprised smaller districts would see more tensions as they balance their budgets.
It's a difficult situation when you're dealing with a lack of resources and people have high expectations for what's going to happen in their schools, and it leads to conflict.
Since Act 10, Wisconsin Education Association Council spokeswoman Christina Bry says they've seen more turnover in districts where teachers feel they have less say on the job.
It's really hard to work in an environment where you're told what to do and not asked how that impacts the children you're face-to-face with.
But Nick Novak, who's with the conservative think tank, the McIver Institute, says Act 10 has helped districts like Spooner deal with financial challenges.
That has been able to help balance the budgets of local school districts. It's helped put money back into the classroom. In many districts, it's allowed them to increase teacher-based pay, allowed them to increase programming.
But retired Spooner teacher Carlo Kumpula says it's not always about money.
It's about respect.
Several current and recently retired teachers declined to comment. Some cited concerns over retaining benefits, and others referred comments to administration. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.